I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Public health experts have said for weeks now that social distancing can reduce the spread of coronavirus and bend the curve of infection. Many governors, including here in the tri-state area, have had residents living under stay-at-home orders and have forced businesses to shutter their doors, although they are beginning to loosen some of those restrictions. Our guest, Daniel Hopkins, is the author of a new study funded by the Leonard Davis Institute at the University of Pennsylvania that investigated the attitude of Pennsylvanians about policies aimed at reducing the spread of coronavirus. He's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and joins us to tell us what he found. And Dan Hopkins, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, we want to know your opinion about some of these orders or restrictions coming from the local government here in Pennsylvania. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Dan, why Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania is a critical state politically. It is also one of the states that's been not to the extent of New York, but relatively hard hit, as we were just hearing, by coronavirus. But partly also, Pennsylvania is my home. Pennsylvania is a diverse state, and I think that you can see a lot of the trends nationally right here in Pennsylvania. And at the same time, by doing a survey in just one state, we can really learn how Pennsylvanians are responding, for instance, to information that they get from Governor Wolf. We can ask some of the more specific questions that may not apply across the 50 states.
Well, let's talk about where Pennsylvanians are getting their information and how they think about it and whether it resonates with them. Help us understand that.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, this is an age in which many of us spend a lot of time online. But one of the critical things that we've seen in this survey is that overwhelmingly Pennsylvanians are still getting their information from the sources that they've traditionally relied on. So that's television, and then to a lesser extent, radio and newspapers. And they're hearing a lot from, you know, figures like Governor Wolf and Mayor Kenney, but that's coming through the traditional sources. People are watching a lot of television. They're listening to a fair amount of radio, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. There was a question about trust in medical experts, and I'm assuming that's referring to people like Dr. Fauci and others. For Democrats, a great deal, 80%. For Republicans, a great deal, 38%. For independents, a great deal, 56%. So that's at least when it comes to how a great deal of trust in medical experts, we can see a divide.
Yes, I think that survey question is emblematic of what we see throughout the survey. So this is a survey that we did in early April with just under 2,000 Pennsylvania residents. And one of the things that we see time and again is that there are majorities, significant majorities, who, for instance, trust medical experts, who endorse different social distancing policies, who believe that we need to prioritize keeping people healthy over reopening the economy. But you also do see partisan differences. You do see that consistently Republicans are less trusting of Governor Wolf. Republicans are more interested in reopening the economy sooner and a little bit less supportive of indefinite social distancing policies. And that mirrors what we've been seeing in other national surveys as well.
Let me pick up on that. But one other thing, I looked at trust in medical experts. So we see this divide when it comes to great deal. But when you add a good amount of trust in medical experts, so that some degree of trust, it's closer to 80% for all those three groups.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that speaks to one of the main things that we see, that, for instance, Democrats are expressing extremely high levels, whether it's trust or, for instance, if you look at social distancing, 82% of Democrats said that it's extremely important to practice social distancing, while just 44% of Republicans say it's extremely important. But then if you say, well, is it very important, then you get a lot of Republicans. So that I think that while there are partisan nuances, the broad take-home is that whether they're Republicans, Democrats, or independents, Pennsylvania residents in our survey support social distancing and really are concerned about the coronavirus and willing to take significant steps to try to mitigate its spread.
And again, to add up, extremely vary and somewhat, you come up with about 90%, which tells us that less than 10% of Pennsylvanians and maybe even the country disapprove of social distancing. Am I over extrapolating there, Dan?
No, I think that's right. And I think that we've seen that both in our survey of Pennsylvania and in Kaiser Family Foundation national surveys, that support for social distancing and stay-at-home policies has been extraordinarily high. And it has been, you know, I've been doing political polling in different ways for 15 years. One of the things you almost always see is that there's a ceiling of about 55% support for most policies. But this case, we're breaking that ceiling. We're seeing that, for instance, the Kaiser Family Foundation had reported from a mid-April poll that upwards of just about 80% of people say that shelter-in-place policies are worth it.
Interesting. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Daniel Hopkins, and he's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, talking about a study that just came out looking at how Pennsylvanians feel about things like stay-at-home orders and social distancing, how they feel about what medical experts are saying. You can join us again. We'd be curious about your reaction to some of these policies. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Dan, as you said, you've been doing polling for some time now. Was there anything that leaped out at you that you thought was unusual since we're living under the stresses of this pandemic?
I would say two things. One, which I already mentioned, is the fact that you typically see a kind of ceiling of support for any high-profile policy at somewhere around 55 or 60%. But in this case, we're seeing significant majorities in support of a range of policies to fight coronavirus. One thing I will say, though, is that there is not a lot of support in our survey for using cell phones to enforce quarantines. And that, again, is a finding that has been echoed by other surveys done elsewhere in the country. We find the Democrats are about evenly split as to whether the government should be using cell phones to enforce quarantines, and Republicans and independents are significantly opposed to such policies. But that's one, I think, really noteworthy thing from our study. And then the other thing that we use the study to do is to look at whether people were especially likely or unlikely to follow advice when it was attributed to experts. And one of the findings that's reassuring in an era when we're getting so much critical information from medical experts and from journalists and from public officials is that there was no group that was less responsive when we said that this advice was being urged, that social distancing was being urged by those elite groups, by medical experts or by public officials. And in fact, for respondents 65 and older, they were more likely to say that social distancing is extremely important after they hear that it had been urged by those expert groups.
And does everyone agree on what an expert is?
I think that there's no.
Okay.
I certainly don't think that there is universal agreement about what an expert is. But that said, what we have found and what others have found as well is that non-political groups, that medical experts, as you mentioned earlier, received a great deal of trust across the board in our survey, that nurses, doctors are traditionally high trust groups as well. And so while there continue to be the clear residues of partisan division, there are also clearly expert groups, including medical professionals, whom members of the public in general are looking to for advice and help in this situation.
Dave has a comment. He says, I'm a Republican. I have a natural skepticism of government. It's not that we don't trust our government. It's simply that we disagree. Interesting comment. And when you do these surveys, can you get as granular as that?
That's a great question. And I would say certainly that one of the things that survey researchers have seen time and time again is that when Republicans are in office, Democrats are a bit less trusting of the government, and when Democrats are in office, Republicans are less trusting of the government. But also, exactly as I think the caller's the writer's name was Dave, had said, that Republicans very understandably have a naturally more skeptical inclination towards government. And we see that in some respects, for instance, with respect to using cell phones to enforce quarantines, many Americans adopt what would be thought of as a conservative position. That is to say, many Americans are alarmed about the prospect of, say, using cell phones to enforce quarantines. There's one other interesting finding in our data, which is that there's very, very strong support for policies to bar people from other localities from entering Pennsylvania communities. And that's something that's obviously not gotten a lot of discussion, but I would just flag that there's a lot of support for, you know, preventing newcomers from entering our communities and potentially bringing the virus with them.
Well, and that raises a whole host of questions about the fact that we don't have enough testing to know, you know, who is an asymptomatic carrier and who's not.
Absolutely. We are still in the early stages of getting all the data that we need. But I do hope that with surveys like this one, which was you know, funded on a very, very short turnaround by the Leonard Davis Institute, that at least we're laying the groundwork for starting to collect some of the essential data, because we need so much data to really understand what policies are going to be effective in fighting coronavirus. And I think that surveys like this one, I hope, are just the very, very tip of the iceberg in terms of data collection.
Well, as you mentioned, this was done about a month ago, and I mean, I think there is clearly both growing concern and frustration, and also we're beginning to see states beginning to open some of their doors and loosening some of these restrictions. So it'll be interesting to see how especially Pennsylvanians feel as we slowly, you know, get back to some kind of weird new normal.
Absolutely. We're in the field now with a second survey, and we're going to be in the field yet again with a statewide survey in anticipation of the June 2nd primary. So we will continue to be tracking a lot of these sentiments.
Did you see regional differences, how people might feel in the Delaware Valley versus in the more rural parts of Pennsylvania?
That's a great question. And our survey doesn't quite have some of the sample sizes you might want. Some of the national surveys have shown that while there is an overwhelming commitment to social distancing, there is about a 10 percentage point gap in say, the share of people who are extremely concerned about coronavirus or feel that their lives have been disrupted in the places that have been the hardest hit. But if you look at communities where the caseloads are higher, understandably, those are places where people are especially likely to report in national surveys that their lives have been disrupted, and also especially likely to say that we need to be focusing on social distancing and not moving ahead with reopening the economy.
And about 20 seconds here, protests get a lot of coverage, protests against all these policies we've been talking about. Does that give us a skewed view?
I think it gives us one. Yes, I think it gives us a skewed view. I think that part of what's so important about surveys like this is precisely that there are many, many people who are not appearing on television or on Twitter. And I think that by doing surveys like this, we can get a sense of the opinions held by millions of Pennsylvania residents who are, you know, dutifully in their homes, or maybe they're essential workers, but they're not able to participate in political protests. But
sure,
Nonetheless, their views are going to be absolutely critical as we think about what policies can garner support moving forward.
Dan Hopkins, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Joining us now is Vikram Palarkar. He's an oncologist and researcher at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, and he's a novelist. His new book, Night Theater, is set in a rundown clinic in rural India, where a burned-out surgeon is visited by a family of murder victims who ask him to bring them back from the dead. If he can't help them, they will die again by morning. Vikram Palarkar says he wanted to answer several questions with this story. What if a doctor doesn't believe in their work anymore? What is our place in the cosmos? How do we think about God as a source of the meaning of life? And how does corruption infect a society? He grew up in Mumbai. His parents are retired physicians, and he lived above their hospital, given free rein to the place, wandering halls, and even watching his father do surgeries. Quite an education. Vikram Palarkar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. And I'm sorry we have to do this by phone. I normally like to talk to novelists in the studio, but obviously we cannot do that.
Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. I'd love to have you, and hopefully you can hold the phone and read from your book, but I'd love to have you read the very beginning of your new novel.
Sure. The day the dead visited the surgeon, the air in his clinic was laced with formaldehyde. His pharmacist had poured some into a beaker in the operating room and given it a night to scour every corner. Once the door was opened, the acrid fumes spilled into the corridor, and death leached out of the walls. This was the usual death, the mundane kind, that of insects and vermin. The previous afternoon, a farmer had slit open the forearm of another with a sickle. They rushed up the hillock and crowded into the clinic, five farmers with a red trail behind them, holding the wound shut with a grimy rag. The surgeon peeled off the cloth and saw the laceration from elbow to wrist. "How did this happen?" he asked. The injured man snarled through gritted teeth. "This dog did it." Beside him, the accused hung his head. "I was cutting the grain, Dr. Sahib. I didn't see him bending down to pick up the bundle. Please stitch him up. I'll pay." The surgeon pressed the rag back onto the wound. "It may not be so easy," he said. His pharmacist was standing by his side, ready with gloves on her hands. He passed the farmer's forearm over to her and let her lead the man to the operating room. The surgeon followed, stepping over the drops of blood in the man's wake. The other farmers stayed in the corridor. One of them pulled out a pouch of tobacco from his pocket. "Don't spit on my walls," warned the surgeon, and he closed the door.
And that's our guest, Vikram Palarkar, reading from his new novel. It is called Night Theater. You did not bury the lead at the very first sentence of your novel, "The Day the Dead Visited the Surgeon." Help us understand who this surgeon is.
So this surgeon is, in some ways, a moral person who is the victim of being embedded within a corrupt society. So because of events that become clear later in the novel, the surgeon has had to leave his rather comfortable surgical practice in a big city and then go work in this nameless, dilapidated clinic in a village. And the experience magnifies all of his worst qualities, which are his ego, his feeling that he's smarter than everyone around him, and also a sense of self-righteousness that he has. And I thought that actually would be a very interesting protagonist to place in the novel, a very dysfunctional and flawed human being who is faced with a cosmic challenge and has to find his own humanity through it.
Is it based on anyone you know?
It's actually based on a composite of various different characters that I've seen throughout my life. So I don't think there's a single person, but I do think there's a certain kind of paternalism that sometimes creeps into medical practice at the same time as a distance between the doctor and the patient. And so I wanted to explore both of those things through my characters.
You have said that you've been interviewed about this book before, but you've said that the idea for this novel came in a, quote, flash, and that you wrote it during your medical training. What was the moment that led to that flash?
Well, I finished writing my first book, The Afflictions, and I was looking for another place to pour my creative, another kind of work to pour my creative energies into. And the image of the dead coming to a doctor's doorstep and pleading for him to bring them back to life suddenly appeared to me. And very quickly, I actually took me about a week to flesh out the overall outlines of the plot and the place in which it would be set. And it was a really wonderful experience to have a story unfold itself to me.
And I mean, as you said, you'd written a book before, but this idea of sort of having this moment when all of a sudden you see the beginnings of a book before you, that must be pretty heady.
Yes, it is quite. And it's also perhaps an interesting insight into how writers come up with their ideas. I don't think writers actually formulate their ideas. The ideas just present themselves. But I would say that the themes that ended up forming sort of the backbone of the narrative of the book really had been boiling, simmering in my mind for many, many years before I began writing the book. And so I suppose the subconscious, my subconscious, spat out the premise of this book.
You do take us through these series of operations that this surgeon does, and he's called the surgeon pretty much through the entire book, or as the writer, you call him the surgeon. But we really get a sense of what it's like to slice somebody open and to piece them back together or stitch them back together. Is that based on some of your own experiences?
Yes, so you mentioned that the surgeon is referred to as the surgeon. Actually, all of the characters in the book, none of them have names, and they're all referred to as identifiers. And that was a very deliberate decision. I wanted the narrative to have a certain kind of universality that came from de-identifying all of the characters. As for the surgical aspects itself, I did think very carefully about how much surgical detail to include in the book. I'm not a surgeon myself, but I think all of us during our medical training have seen enough surgeries that we understand the nuances of them. In some ways, I approach the way a science fiction writer might do, including enough detail to act as a skeleton for the story and yet allow other aspects such as the narrative and the conversations to progress.
Well, I must say, it fascinated me. I mean, as someone who just are obviously looking at it from afar, as someone reading a novel, but just fascinating. And I think it helps us understand that extraordinary responsibility that a surgeon has to either slice someone open or put them back together.
Yes, and so one of the things that I think very often non-medical professionals don't understand about the practice of medicine is the kind of weight that lies on a doctor's shoulders. And in essence, they are doing something to the patient that could actually take the patient's life, but they're doing it for a purpose of preserving the patient's life and restoring the patient to health. I think that some parts of I'm actually an oncologist, and one of my jobs is to give chemotherapy to patients. And every time I'm writing an order of a chemotherapy, I actually say to myself, "This is a life-threatening medication," and I remind myself that what I'm giving is a medication that I must be very careful about, that I must think very carefully about what I'm doing, that I must give the exact right dosage of the drug. And so I tried to import a lot of that psychology into this book and try to convey to the reader how high stakes medical interventions, in this case surgeries, are.
Well, this surgeon works in, it's a rural clinic in India. It has cockroaches, it has vermin, there are not enough equipment to actually allow him to do his job. The vaccines for polio are, you know, late to arrive. And not that everything is about the pandemic today, but it made me think about doctors and nurses and other medical staff, again, on the front lines, not having enough masks or enough gowns in order to be able to do their job. Now, I know you wrote this before the pandemic, but I thought there were some interesting parallels there.
Well, yeah, you know, when the book was reaching publishers and I was looking to get it published, I wondered if the idea of a medical professional lacking adequate supplies working in the corrupt system would resonate with the American public. But I think all of a sudden, because of the pandemic, I think that's going to really resonate with a lot of people. I do think that the one element that might have parallels with our current situation is that the surgeon in my novel is in some ways risking his own life and his own welfare to provide services to these extraordinary victims who come seeking his care. And I think we do see some parallel in that today, in that doctors and nurses are constantly exposing themselves and their families to coronavirus in order to fulfill their Hippocratic oath. And just as a surgeon in my novel accepts the fear and accepts these challenges and proceeds, that is exactly what you're seeing. Doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals are accepting the challenges of this extraordinary moment and really stepping up to the plate.
He seems clearly, you know, burned out, frustrated, angry. As you say, he doesn't have all these sort of benevolent qualities that we sometimes associate or hope to associate with a physician, but he's kind of had it with everything.
Yes, and I think that really speaks to, you know, a doctor can provide excellent compassionate care when the doctor is given sufficient resources, is surrounded by a system that allows the doctor to function and is allowed to rest and recover his own soul in a way. But when you have, and this happens all over the world, the doctors are functioning in incredibly deprived circumstances, are constantly battling corruption, government corruption that prevents supplies from reaching the clinic, and they're working in situations where they're exhausted or sleep deprived. And that does take a toll. And I wanted my novel to begin with a surgeon who was burned out and who was drained of empathy, and as you mentioned, who is questioning the worth of his own work. In a way, the book was an experiment in trying to answer the question, what happens if you take a doctor like this and place before him a challenge that no other doctor in the world has ever faced, which is bringing the dead back to life? Exactly. How does the surgeon respond to it?
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. I'd love to have you read another section from the book. That's Vikram Palarkar. He's an oncologist and researcher at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a novelist. And we're talking about his new book. It's called Night Theater. And again, set in a clinic in rural India, this surgeon is frankly visited by a family of murder victims, mother, father, and son, and they ask this doctor to bring them back from the dead. Vikram, I'd love to have you read another section. This is the beginning of chapter 3.
Yes, in the beginning of chapter 3, the dead have appeared in the surgeon's clinic after sunset, and they have shown the surgeon wounds on their bodies that they could not possibly have survived. But the surgeon, of course, cannot accept the fact that these people are dead, and so they begin to tell him what happened to them. Chapter 3. We had gone to a fair near our village, said the man who called himself a teacher. It was sunset by the time we left. The street was dark. The bulbs in the lampposts had burned out. I didn't think much of it then, didn't turn back. God knows how I've repented that. Four men were hiding there. We jumped out, took our money and jewelry, and then they stabbed us, Dr. Sahib, stabbed us and left us on the roadside, like sacks of garbage. They just left us there and disappeared. The visitors were pale. There was a sickly tone to their skin, that was true. But how? When did this happen? The surgeon asked. This evening, said the teacher. But there was no fair here. I didn't hear of any. It didn't happen here, Sahib. We're from another district. But that doesn't make any sense, said the surgeon. How did you get here? The sun just set not even an hour ago. And how did you stop your bleeding? We didn't. The surgeon felt his toes curl in his shoes, press hard against the leather. But then, how did you survive? We didn't.
And again, another section from Night Theater, putting myself into the surgeon's shoes with his curled toes, trying to imagine. Obviously, this is a kind of, I guess, for lack of a better word, a kind of magical realism. But this idea of the dead coming back and wanting to live again.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, the word magical realism is an interesting term. It, of course, comes from the works of classically to describe 100 Years of Solitude and other works by Latin American fabulists. And I actually would prefer to think of my work more as just hyper-realism, but with a dimension of unreality to it. And so the setting is, I hope, very real and something that the reader can imagine. And the constraints that the surgeon has are also real. But in this situation, he's faced with these extraordinary individuals. And so it's a hyper-realism with dead people.
All right. Okay. Are we talking zombies here?
Well, no. So these are thinking, speaking individuals who are capable of feeling emotion and compassion, and who are also capable of feeling betrayed or lying. But they are here to ask for the surgeon's help so that they can return back to their previous state, which was to live on this earth.
In fact, quoting from the novel, you say the surgeon observing the dead for the first time was struck by how like the living they looked. And there was a question about sort of, you know, who is who? Which side of life and death is on? Is somebody on?
Yes. So I think for the surgeon, really the realization that he has to help these patients comes from the understanding that really the dead in this story are no different from the living in terms of their desire to live. And I think that is something that every doctor has experienced, because no matter who you care for, no matter how different that person is from you, whether they may have a different skin color or may speak a different language or may have completely different social circumstances, at the end of the day, they are human, and so is the doctor. And that is perhaps one of the reasons why doctors do what they do, because they recognize the person in front of them to be no different from themselves and their loved ones.
We're almost up on our break here, but I'm wondering whether, and maybe I'm speaking more for myself, I haven't had a lot of surgery in my life, but I would like a surgeon to feel as if they were, you know, omnipotent, as if they were, had some of these godlike qualities.
Oh, well, I would... I don't know if that's, I don't know, but I don't know if any doctor thinks of themselves in that way. I think most doctors feel a sense of humility and also the enormity of what they're dealing with. And I think that is important, the ability to know what you can do, to know your limits, and the willingness to ask questions of your colleagues when you come across problems that are difficult for you to solve by yourself. Actually, to me, I think the real the best practice of medicine comes from collaborativeness, where multiple people at multiple different levels in the system, whether it's doctors or nurses, across multiple different departments, come together and come up with a plan that uses the intellect, not of just one omnipotent person, but of multiple people, each with their own area of expertise.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And I'm talking with Vikram Palarkar. He's an oncologist and researcher at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a writer. His first book, The Afflictions, was about imaginary diseases. We've been talking about his new novel, Night Theater. And again, it's about a burned-out surgeon working in a clinic in India, asked to bring a family back from the dead. Our guest grew up in Mumbai above his parents' hospital. He could actually wander the hospital halls and even watch his dad perform surgery. And he joins us to talk about some of these heady questions about life and death and morality, even cosmic justice. And you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us to join the conversation. We've touched on a lot of very provocative and timely issues. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Your novel was published a year or so ago in India, actually had a different name, The Wounds of the Dead. And I'm curious about the reaction in India to this story, which is obviously set in India, and the reaction here in the United States.
Well, I think the one way in which I think Indian readers immediately could recognize the setting is because I think everyone in India has visited some kind of village and has seen a situation where there are tiny clinics with almost no resources in them. And I think this idea medical limitation and the absence of medical resources is something that unfortunately is very familiar to a lot of people in India and also in the developing world. And a number of readers in India also felt that they could really resonate at a personal level with the way in which the doctor in the book has to struggle with the corrupt system in which he finds himself, where you can bribe and get by, or you can refuse to bribe and end up in a situation where you are disadvantaged or even sometimes punished for standing up on principle. And I think that perhaps is an experience that isn't yet commonplace in day-to-day life in America, that there's no expectation when you're stopped by, problematic if when you're stopped by a police officer for running a red light, if you try to slip a $50 bill or a $20 bill to the police man to try to get off without getting a license. But that is the reality of how things happen in India. So there were certain aspects of this that definitely resonated with Indian readers because they had lived them.
And this is for the surgeon. I mean, this is one of the reasons it seems that he is so burned out.
Yes, and this aspect of it actually comes from things that I've witnessed myself. So one of the unfortunate systems that is developed in medicine in India is a system of financial kickbacks, where the specialist gives a kickback to the family practitioner who refers him or her patient, and then the radiologist gives a kickback to the surgeon who sends the patient over to get a CT scan, and the pathologist gives a kickback to for referring patients to get a blood draw. And this system of kickbacks, financial kickbacks, creates a system where a patient can never be truly sure if the referrals that they're being given or the care they're getting are appropriate for their medical care or they are serving a larger financial and corrupt purpose. And I'm really grateful for the fact, I mean, I practice at the University of Pennsylvania, nothing of that sort exists in at least in the ecosystem in which I find myself. But that was one of the aspects of Indian medicine that I find very distressing. And I've seen over the years many people of my parents' generation and now even doctors of my own generation feeling burned out by this constant compromise of their principles.
I'm curious, too, and I do want to talk a little bit about your growing up and your parents and living above the hospital and all that, but I'm just also wondering, since this book is published both in India and here in the United States, about how, if you can see differences about how these two countries view death or have a connection or a closeness to death. Of course, this pandemic has brought us much closer to the experience of death, but from your perspective, do these two countries view that differently?
Well, I would say the question is very complicated, and there are many dimensions to the way individuals and societies view death, and the way in which people approach death when they're nearing the end of their lives. I do feel in India there is perhaps an excessive sense of equanimity, and in the United States there is too little of it, in that in India very often people would refuse life-saving treatments once they reach their 70s, because they just feel it's not worth it to continue to live any further, or worth it to spend enormous amounts of money to live any further. On the other end of the spectrum in the United States, you see a tremendous amount of money being spent and many painful and futile procedures being done in the last 2 weeks of an individual's life. And I have to think that there's some sort of Goldilocks position somewhere in between the two, where we both recognize that age by itself shouldn't be a reason to not provide medical treatments of various kinds, including surgeries and chemotherapy, but also recognize that there is a time when doctors and patients have to step back and say, are we providing care that is actually helping the patient and improving the quality of life as opposed to making it worse? And I think that's a discussion that's had on a day-to-day basis in the oncology world, where we have cancers where, for example, I treat acute leukemia, where even now with significant advancements recently in treatment, there's still about 60 or 70% mortality. And so very often in many patients' lives, we reach a point where one has to ask a question about whether pushing for the treatments, pushing expensive treatments and toxic treatments is going to be beneficial to the patient and also to the society. So I would say that's one big difference in which the practice of medicine in India is quite different from the practice of medicine in the United States.
I appreciate that answer, and it's obviously just so profound and so important to think about. Let me ask you a little bit about growing up in Mumbai. Both your parents were physicians. They're retired physicians, and you lived above a hospital that they started. What was that like? I mean, help us. This doesn't happen so much here in the United States.
That's right. So the idea of boutique hospitals perhaps existed in the United States in the earlier part of the 20th century, but I don't think it exists really at this point anymore. But it's quite common in India. The hospital is about my parents' hospital is about the same age as me. So maybe a year or two before I was born, my parents bought a flat in a residential building and began a clinic over there. And then they, as the practice began to increase, they bought neighboring flats and broke down the walls in between and expanded it eventually into a hospital which had an operating room, a labor room, clinics, and beds for patients. And this was in a residential complex, and we lived on the second floor of the building with the hospital on the ground level. And throughout my childhood, the hospital was expanding, and my parents would go down in the morning, take care of patients, so have breakfast with us, go down, come back up for lunch, and then go down again and take care of patients for the rest of the day. And so I was very familiar with medical lingo as a kid, and I think aspects of medicine and surgery and childbirth were just part of the air growing up.
And you were able. Was your dad a surgeon?
Yes, so my dad's a retired surgeon. My mother is a retired OB/GYN.
Oh, wow. And you were able to watch surgeries and childbirth and all of that as a young person growing up?
Yes, so not childbirth, but I have watched several surgeries, appendix extractions, gallbladder removals. And so I have, I remember at the age of eight getting wearing scrubs and scrubbing up and going into the operating room and standing on the little stool in the corner and looking into the surgery.
And what was the experience for an eight-year-old? I'm trying to imagine.
You know, I don't necessarily remember my emotional reaction to it, but to me it was just natural that these are things that have to be done to help people.
You're an oncologist. I'm curious about why you chose that as a profession.
I'm a hematologist oncologist, and my specialty is in leukemia. I'm just fascinated with the way in which our bone marrow produces cells, billions and billions of cells every day to keep our blood system going, and it's just an extraordinarily fascinating scientific question to understand how that happens and how when mutations occur in that system, the system spins out of control and you end up with individual cells committing basically mutiny against the body and turning into a cancer. And so I have a research lab and I study how mutations in genes in the bone marrow lead to leukemia, and I treat patients with leukemia. So my desire to work on this was both scientific and also a consequence of individual patients that I saw during my residency whose lives resonated with me.
And what brought you to the United States?
Oh, well, I came to the United States primarily because I wanted to be a physician scientist. And the kind of career where you can have a research lab of your own and also see patients is just not something that exists in India. And also, India, unfortunately, doesn't have the kinds of resources that would allow a cutting-edge research. And so that's what brought me to the United States.
I was thinking about the title of your novel, Night Theater, and we can, I mean, obviously when we talk about surgeries, it's I believe the language is that it's a surgical theater, but it is a kind of performance, it is a kind of stage. By choosing that name, are you thinking in theater terms?
So I wish I could take credit for that title.
Okay.
As you had mentioned earlier in the interview, the book was actually published in India under the title The Wounds of the Dead, which was the title that I had originally given it. And then when I was signing on with publishers in the UK and the US, the UK publisher wanted to change the title, and he was the one who suggested Night Theater, which, I mean, the moment he suggested it, I realized that I should have been the one to come up with it myself, because right. it was just so absolutely perfect. And it actually works on several levels. So the entire story takes place over the course of one night. And so it is a nocturnal novel, so to speak. And most of the events are in an operating theater. But also the setting of the book was very deliberately contained, because I wanted the surgeon to feel not only physically and medically isolated, but also morally isolated, in that there's no one there who can guide him in any decision-making. He has to take upon himself the entire moral weight of making life and death decisions for the patients who have come to him. And as a result, the entire story is set within one clinic in the course of one night, with only mm-hmm. about six or so characters. And so it does have the feel of a stage play, although I hadn't quite thought of it myself before my publisher pointed it out. And so, which is why, yes, the title Night Theater is excellent. And I personally prefer it to the one that I myself came up with.
That's interesting. It would be interesting to see it as a play, just the idea of that. I also read that you're working on another book, sounds like a novel, about a man who makes prosthetic eyes. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so in between trying to run my lab and seeing patients, I'm trying to squeeze in a little bit of fiction writing. So I'm working on a third novel. The protagonist is a man who makes prosthetic eyes for people who have lost an eye. And what his clients do not, and in order to make these eyes, he has to look with a magnifying glass into the good eye of his client for hours and hours while he replicates every detail. And he makes the most exquisite eyes anyone has ever seen. But what his wow. clients don't know is that when he looks into their eyes, he can see the past and the future. And the book begins with him seeing something that obliges him to interfere in the life of one of his characters, which makes things spin out of control.
And we don't want to give too much away here. You thank your parents in the book, in your new book, for enveloping your childhood in books. Did that help you think of yourself or want to be a writer?
One of my fondest memories as a kid is going to a book fair that used to be organized in a large park in Mumbai, where book vendors would set up tents and the entire park would be full of just booksellers and piles of books. And we would go to these fairs, and I was never prohibited from purchasing any book that I wanted. And so we would come home with sacks full of books that I would read throughout the next year. And as a result, I think I developed a love of books and a love of writing ever since my early childhood, and that has carried throughout my life. I'm sure that had a lot to do with the fact that I write.
Was there a favorite childhood book? We're almost out of time here, but a book that just is in your heart from your childhood?
Ooh, that's a difficult question. I really like the works of P.G. Woodhouse, because they were Wooster and G series of books, because they were just extraordinarily funny and witty. And I would say those are the books I really enjoyed reading as an early teenager.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. I'm sorry we're doing this remotely. Vikram Paralkar, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty, and really nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too. And he's an oncologist, a researcher at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. He's a writer. His first book, The Afflictions, about imaginary diseases, and the book we talked about during this hour, Night Theater. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can always find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. There's always lots of information there for you about Radio Times. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.